Rest those feet. Rest those feet. Nehemiah chapter 5. If you've got your Bibles, go ahead and turn to Nehemiah chapter 5. We have our Wednesday night study, and it's been good to get to study this particular chapter and get to go over it again, I guess you would say, in one aspect. So it's good to have some visitors here this morning. Good to have you guys with us as well. So we're glad that you are here. God called three men up to heaven in a vision. Three men to teach them or to tell them that the end of the world was coming. He's wanting them to tell his people. So 30 days. He's like, I'll get 30 days. So he calls up to heaven Vladimir Putin and President Trump and Bill Gates. And he says, hey, I got to tell you guys, the world's going to end in 30 days. I need you to announce and let everybody know that the world's going to end. So Vladimir Putin is the first to announce to his people. And he says, well, I've got bad news and I've got terrible news. The bad news is we were wrong. There is a God and I saw him. And that's bad news. But the terrible news is we only have 30 days before he's going to end the world. Well, President Trump called his people together. And he says, well, I got bad news and I got good news. But the good news first is that we were right. There is a God. Our religion was correct. The bad news is we've got 30 days before he's going to destroy the world. Well, Bill Gates says, well, I've got great news and I've got even better news. So he calls all of his folks together and he says this. The good news is I'm one of the three most important men in the world because God called me to go hang out with him. But the better news is we don't have to roll out the next version of Microsoft Windows. We're good to go. I like Bill Gates. I like the story of Bill Gates. You know, in 2008, he walked away from Microsoft essentially and opened up the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And they have done some incredible things. And I bring that up because they have given over $35 billion, $35 billion to different charities, some faith-based organizations. The Salvation Army is one of those. World Vision, which is an organization that we've worked with in the past. Catholic organizations, Lutheran groups. 125 different foundations and different groups have benefited from this $35 billion. It's interesting because Gates himself says he's kind of religious. He's interesting to listen to because somebody that's developed software and created so many things, he says, I just don't buy into the fact that everything just happened by chance. There's too much organization and creativity there for me to not believe that there was a God, because it doesn't make sense to me not to believe that there's a God. But his wife is extremely religious. She's extremely religious. And I think it's really, she has a basic religion. I mean, it's kind of basic, but it's not anything that she's not willing to do something about. That's what I wanted to bring that story up. What their motivation may be, I can't essentially say what the motivation is, but it seems to be very moral in nature. I mean, essentially, they're saying we need to do something. And the sermon title this morning is Do Something About It. When you see something that needs to be done, you should do something about it. At a concert last week, we went to, one of the speakers was from Ohio. And he was a pastor who was really trying to push pretty hard these programs of these world organizations who adopt children. Not necessarily adopt kids, even though he's adopted some children. But to take a child, you know, they have their picture on this packet, and they hand those pictures out, and you sign up for $30 or $35 a month, somewhere in that area, and that's your child, and you help provide food for this child, and you help provide school clothing and different things like that. And it's just an incredible program. And he pushed it pretty hard. And I loved the fact that he was saying, hey, we can do something about the world crisis. We can do something. It's important. But one of the analogies he used was that there's 7 billion people in the world. And if you could, you know, cram those 7 billion people into 100 individuals to get 100% kind of a thing and did a percentile, he said The kids that we're trying to help are in the very back of the line when it comes to money and opportunity and you know, having the wherewithal to be able to do anything about it. And, of course, Americans are all in the front of the line. Most of our kids are in the front because we have every opportunity under the sun, and our kids have all these opportunities, you know, to do things like that. I was talking with Jackson and Ryan this morning, and they worked with their grandpa and made some money over spring break. And I was thinking, you know, what a good thing to work, you know, to work that hard as young men that they were doing, and excited about it. You know, they were making some pretty good money, but getting to work with their grandfather as well and looking forward to that more in the future. But those opportunities don't exist. I mean, they're non-existent for some kids in certain countries because there's no work for them to do, and the work that they do is literally for survival. Forbes magazine wrote this: the typical person, and I think I put this up there. Yeah, I did. The typical person in the bottom 5% of the American income distribution is still richer than 68% of the world's inhabitants. So put that into perspective. The lowest 5% in America that would be considered poor or poverty-stricken in America, that's the bottom 5%, is still richer than almost 70% of the whole world. And that tells you a lot about how we are in America. So it made me think, how do I use the resources? And so therefore, since I'm thinking about it and get to preach about it this morning, how are you using and how am I using the resources that God has given us? And we talk about giving here for us and what we do to maintain a building and to maintain our bills and things like that. And that's important. But do you have a fingerprint even further in the world? What are you doing with your wealth that God gives us? There was a study done in 2012 by a guy by the name of Paul Piff. Interesting name. Because I know on America's Got Talent, there was a guy that was a comedian called Piff the Dragon. And that's a funny name to me. But this guy's name is Paul Piff. And he was researching the effect that power has on people. And so he uses all kinds of different experiments. But in this one experiment, he took the basic game of Monopoly, right? Just the basic game of Monopoly. And he uses that game to show what power can do. And I promise you, it totally applies to our lesson this morning. So hang with me. Some of you are probably going, what does this have to do with our lesson this morning? But what Piff did was he did a two-person game of Monopoly. So me and Scott are going to play Monopoly. All right? But the game is rigged, because what he's rigged. It's pretty good little pun in there. So I gave, you know, what he did is he gave Scotty a big fistful of money and both dice. But to me, I got half the money and only one die. So, I mean, not that affects the game a lot, but, you know, you pass go and collect $200. The faster you can get around there, the more money you make. And so I'm limited to how far I can go and how much money I have. Well, what's interesting is the power person, the person with the power that had the more money and the dice, he said it took just a few minutes and he started noticing results. Very noticeable, acting different. They hogged the space at the table. In other words, leaned over the table. Like if you're playing cards and you're watching somebody play poker sometimes, when they have a really good hand, they have a tendency to sit up in their seat sometimes and they lean over the table like, oh, you know, I got a really good hand. And it's a tell, you know, that people talk about. You know, that's why you kind of keep yourself. Bobby does it all the time. It's really easy to tell when he's got a good hand. But you dominate. I'm just kidding. But actually, you do every once in a while. But you have a tendency to show, you know, a sign of power, kind of a thing. They made less eye contact and started moving the poor player, in this case me, the poor player's pieces for them. So they'd roll and they go, here, let me move that for you. You know, because I've got the power. You know, and he said it was just extremely noticeable. They made more noise when they moved their pieces, like one, two, three, four, you know, just a sign of power. It was really cringy the way they did it, you know. So this, the way they put that together, was, you guys are killing me. Everyone knows the game was rigged. Okay, this is the point. Everyone knew the game was rigged. The players that are playing knew the game was rigged. And yet, the power player still started showing or acting as if he had real power and real status and treated the poor person with less respect. And it was just an interesting result by Piff. And he said very clearly, he said, it was really obvious that we will take advantage of our power whether we realize it or not. So go back to the question, what does God want me to do with my power? Right? With my wealth. Touches my heart. When I think of all of these people that struggle, you know, and I'd like to think that I'm a giving person, but do I look beyond the scope of my world, you know, and think beyond that? You know, as a congregation, we've done some different things worldwide, but, you know, can I help somebody? I mean, I know Karen and I have gone through World Vision and adopted a child in Africa before, and we've done different things in Haiti. Does it impact? Absolutely impacts. So turn to Nehemiah 5, and you're going to see where I was going with all this. Because back then, 3,000 years ago, or about 2,700 years ago, or right around in that area, you've got this same thing taking place, where those who are poor are being taken advantage of by those who are not poor. Nehemiah 5, verses 1 through 6. Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their fellow Jews. Some were saying, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and even stay alive, we must get grain." Basics, right? I mean, those are basics. Others were saying, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our homes to get grain during the famine." Still others were saying, We have to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. And although we're of the same flesh," and I love how they say this, "although we're of the same flesh and the same blood as our fellow Jews, and though our children are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and our daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are," and here's the word, "powerless. Because our fields and our vineyards basically now belong to others. When I, Nehemiah, heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry." So what's taking place, you know, to catch you guys up if you haven't been here, remember the Israelites were put into captivity and then they're allowed to go back home and rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the walls around Jerusalem. But behind the walls, behind the scenes, so to speak, you've got these rich, more powerful Jews who are taking advantage of the ones who owned land, who owned vineyards, who owned different things, and they got in a bad way and they started loaning them money and charging them exorbitant amounts of interest. Now, as we talked about on Wednesday night, according to Deuteronomy chapter 23, verses 19 and 20, God said, you are not allowed to charge interest to your brothers. You're not allowed to charge interest. It's in the law of the commandments that were given by God and said, you can charge foreigners and you can charge aliens. You can charge those outside of Israel, but you don't charge your own folks. So they're breaking the law. And what they're also doing is breaking this moral code of how can I take care of my neighbor? How can I love folks the way I need to love them? Well, they're just taking advantage of it. And Nehemiah is not happy about it. And it should make us angry, too, whenever we see injustice being done. Now, I don't know how you feel about this, and I'm not here to make a political statement in regards to the things that are going on with gun control. And these teenagers in Florida, especially, going all over the country and getting a voice, or at least feeling like they have a voice. And I'm not going to come in here and have a political argument as which direction you believe is right. Here's the thing that I'm noticing. At least they're doing something. I mean, they feel like they can make a difference. And I think that's very special on their part. That's just my little extra thought this morning, and I'll get away from that. But the reality is, do something. Do something. And they are. And it helps them to feel like, you know, they can get over their hopelessness, right? That there's nothing going on. But here's the thing, and this is going to be. Well, I'm going to give you some more. I'm going to give you a little extra on this one too. Have you ever noticed we're a country of platforms? We love platforms. We love social media. We love these big stages. But what about the little stages? What about the everyday? Why are some of these kids shooting other students? I'll tell you why they're shooting them, because they're ostracized, they're made fun of, they're bullied, and they're put in a position where they're not accepted. And I get that there's some mental issues with some of these, but the reality is when you see a kid sitting by himself and struggling as a student or even as an adult, shouldn't we migrate toward them? Shouldn't we love them enough to say, hey, come sit with us, so they feel a part of? That's what I'm seeing too. So we like the big stage at times in this country, but it's the everyday that makes a difference. Nehemiah is seeing that, and he says, you know, I don't like it. It makes me angry to see what's taking place. James Strachan, you're not supposed to know who he is necessarily, but he's just a theologian. But he said, he who is not angry at sin is not in love with virtue. You know, when we see things that are sinful, it should make us angry. And being angry is not a sin as long as we don't sin in our anger. You know, Jesus was angry on several occasions. You know, when they're the money changers are in the temple, when they're trying to rip the people off, he gets angry. It's a righteous indignation is our big words for that. But when we see things that are wrong with the world, or we see things that are wrong in the lives of other people, we should have some anger issues, good ones, and try and fix the situation. That's what Nehemiah does. We just need to be a Nehemiah when we see that. I mentioned this Wednesday night, and I didn't want to mention it, but I said it anyway. But there's a professor in a university who was talking about World War II and talking about the atrocities of Hitler. And he was trying to goad the kids, trying to talk the kids into saying something bad about Hitler. And they would not do it because they're like, well, I'm not going to judge Hitler. I mean, the guy killed 6 million innocent people. 6 million just for being a Jew, or just for having a color of skin, or whatever he chose to kill them for. It was his choice. 6 million plus. And they would not say that what he did was wrong. They wouldn't say what he did was evil. You know, because we live in this country of moral relativism. And if we say something's wrong, then we're just judging. But we make those judgments every day. We make all kinds of judgments. Each one of us do. And God is saying to us, look, when you see something that's wrong, you should try and say something about it. Do something about it. But do so with wisdom. That's what I love about this story of Nehemiah. Listen to what he says. I'm going to go back to verse 6. We're going to emphasize verse 7. But he says, when I heard their outcry and these charges, I was angry. Well, I was very angry. Sorry, that was Southern. I was angry. Verse 7, I pondered them in my mind. I pondered them in my mind, and I want to talk about that in just a second. And then accused the nobles and officials. So I thought about it. I counseled myself. I told them, you're charging your own people interest. So I called together a large meeting to deal with them and said, as far as possible, we've brought back our fellow Jews who were sold to the Gentiles, and now you're selling your own people only for them to be sold back to us. They kept quiet, which most people keep quiet when they have nothing to say. They know they're wrong. They admit they're wrong. In fact, they're going to repent and they're going to change their mind, metanoia, and create a new mindset. But it's interesting. Nehemiah pondered them in my mind. I always look at words when I wonder, okay, what other versions say? The Message says, after thinking it over. Believe it or not, there's a complete Jewish Bible. I sometimes go to it when I'm looking at the Old Testament. And it says, I thought the matter over, and then I took issue with the nobles and rulers. The King James Version, the American Standard Version, says, I consulted with myself. I like that one the most. I had a little counseling session with myself. Do you do that? I do that all the time. I sit down with myself and say, you're a moron, you know, or hey, sometimes I'll do this, you know, and then I ask for humbleness, you know, prayer of humbleness. Sometimes you feel really good. I did a pretty good job on that right there. And then other times you're just like, what did I do wrong in that case? I consulted with myself. I counseled myself. I gave myself advice because he was angry. And Nehemiah sets us an example, because the Bible clearly says, hey, don't go to bed angry. You know, think things over when you're mad. Don't open your mouth in anger. Think about it. Sometimes we speak before we think, and sometimes we say things without wisdom and counsel of God. And so what Nehemiah did, Nehemiah was a prayer. We see that all through the book of Nehemiah, that he prays in certain situations. I can't imagine him not praying about this situation before he opens his mouth. And so when he does open his mouth, verse 9, Nehemiah essentially says, "You dishonor God." He tells the people, "You are dishonoring God because of what you're doing to each other. All the other nations are looking at us and saying, how can you believe that there's a God, or how can you say that you're worshiping a God when you can't even do what your God asks you to do? You're just representing him in the wrong way." And it shows to the other nations, maybe their faith in God is not as strong as they thought. And I think, you know, as we mentioned this Wednesday night, that can happen to us when we don't act out our faith, when we don't live it out the way we're supposed to. People oftentimes judge God by our actions. Or they'll say, "Well, you're a Christian and you act like that. You're supposed to be different. You're supposed to be a changed people." And so it reflects badly on our Father. And I think that that's important for us to remember. What did they do? They repented. They said, "You know what? You're right. We're wrong. And we're going to fix the situation." And so they fix the situation. They're going to give the land back. They're not going to charge interest any longer. And that's a good thing. I made some posters in the past. I printed them out. I think there's still one on the wall, maybe in the youth room. But I've done this on many occasions because we teach a little series of lessons to the teenagers. But the poster says, "It's never wrong to do the right thing." It's never wrong to do the right thing. And Nehemiah is doing the right thing. But it can be wrong to do the right thing with the wrong motivation or the wrong words or the wrong wisdom. When we jump in there and we yell and scream in our anger, we can probably many times do worse damage than if we would just take the time to think about it. So this morning, I'd love to encourage you to think about something, maybe an injustice that you know about, something that you can be thinking of in your mind, and pray to God about it. Counsel with yourself. Ponder it in your mind, think about it, and come up with a great solution that is going to fix that particular situation. We need to use the power for God and not for self. According to the U.S. Marine Corps, I thought this was quite interesting. I actually saw this or a guy was telling me about this when Josh Vita graduated. You know, I took Scott and Jerry and Sarah to go watch his graduation. He wasn't a Marine, he's Army. But from day one, every Marine is taught to live a life worthy of a Marine, right? They're taught to hold one another accountable to a standard of excellence. So they're taught this. If the Marine next to you is falling asleep, is anybody sleeping in right now? Okay, good. Nudge them, give them a nudge. But if a Marine next to you is falling asleep in class, you must have the moral courage to wake him up and motivate him to stay awake. If you're caught sleeping in class at boot camp, not only do you get in trouble for laziness, but the Marine to your left and the Marine to your right get in trouble for lack of moral courage because they should have corrected you when you were wrong. I think that should be a good moral code for most Christians too. I mean, when I see that you're involved in a sin that's damaging the church, or you see me involved in a sin, or maybe I say something that I shouldn't say or do something I should say, we should have the moral courage. We should have the love for one another to say, "Hey, you know what? You're wrong with that." And step back, assess the situation, use a little wisdom, knowledge. I know sometimes we talk about people get their feelings hurt so easy nowadays. Yeah, they do. And we live in a society where if you say something about somebody else's, you know, child rearing or how they're doing something, they go, "What are you doing judging me?" It's like, no, we just live in a different culture. So like it or not, some of us that are older and learn things differently have to realize we still need to handle some folks with kid gloves, don't we? I mean, we need to be but we still need to do something about it. We don't need to just let it slide. We need to say, "Hey, you know, could you do this?" And if they go, "Well, you hurt my feelings," like, "Well, I'm not trying to hurt your feelings. I'm trying to just help you in the situation." I think that's what Nehemiah is trying to do. Remember what the Greek word for encourage is? Somebody help me out. What's the Greek word for encourage? What does it mean? To come alongside, right? To bring somebody next to you to encourage me to keep doing what I need to do. And that's what we're, you know, where we do life together. We encourage one another. We come to each other's side. And sometimes coming to your side means that I've got to share some information that may not be what you want to hear, but it's needful. Nehemiah sets us an incredible example. And what I love about Nehemiah is that he leads by example. You know, I love Jim and Kelly as our leaders. They don't tell me what to do. They don't tell me what to do. But they do come alongside me and they help me. You notice they volunteer for just as many activities and different assessments, you know, whatever needs to be done, as everybody else. You know, I mean, you got them involved in worship, you got them involved in work days, you got involved in Bible hour, you got involved in teaching, they're involved, right? That's what Nehemiah did. That's why Nehemiah was such a great leader. They didn't tell everybody what to do. He didn't tell everybody what to do. He just rolled his sleeves up and jumped in right with them. There's a guy named Jose Mujica. I think that's how you say his name. I'm not for sure. But from March 2010 to March 2015, he was the president of Uruguay, right? The country Uruguay. You can look up where that is. Not a very wealthy country, kind of a poor country. But Mujica's got an interesting story. In November 2012, the BBC, if you get on YouTube, you can actually read a couple stories or see the videos of this BBC reporter. I love it because he's got a British accent, and I love British accents when he's doing all this reporting. And so he's telling this story. He's telling this story from 2012, and he calls Mujica the world's poorest president. Why? Because while most politicians and leaders of their countries live in extravagance, Mujica lives on this old dirt farm with laundry on his front porch and all this. In fact, this is what this guy said. He lives on a tiny farm on a dirt road outside the capital. Laundry is strung outside the house. The water comes from a well in a yard overgrown with weeds, and only two police officers and Manuela, which is a three-legged dog, keep watch outside. He gives 90% of his salary, equivalent to about $12,000 a month, to charities and to the poor. And he lives with the people. In 2010, Uruguay requires all of their politicians to declare their personal wealth. Mujica says, I'm worth $1,800 because he drives a 1987 Volkswagen Beetle. You know, and the video, if you get on YouTube, I almost played it. I was gonna get Shane to put it on there, and then I said, it's not. I'll encourage you to watch it. But apparently, some sheik in some foreign countries offered him $1 million for his 1987 Volkswagen Beetle because he's so impressed with Mujica at the time. But he drives this little Volkswagen Beetle, and they do a story about America and a, you know, $600,000 that we spent on our car for our president to drive with, you know, armor piercing, you know, doors and or safe from being armor pierced. All of the in different countries, $1 million, you know, $600,000, $750,000, and then Mujica drives this Volkswagen Beetle. Mujica doesn't have to live that way. Uruguay provides their president with a mansion in the city, with security and all that stuff. He just chooses not to use it. Makes my eyes water, not because of Mujica. But you think about the fact that Jesus lived in a mansion too. And he said, you know what? I'm going to forego my mansion, and I'm going to come live on the earth. Not as a president, not as a king, not as a prince, but as a pauper. I mean, he lives as a carpenter in a little bitty town called Nazareth. Mujica is a great example to us of what it means to live humbly and to serve humbly. Nehemiah is a great example of that. Mujica is a great example of that. But the greatest example is Jesus. Look at Philippians chapter 2. And we'll close this morning with this verse. I love this because he says, Paul is writing, he says, have this mind. Again, this is, hey, think this way. If you want to change your thinking, then think this. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped or something that he could even hang on to. But he emptied himself, poured all of that out because of his humbleness, by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in that human form, as a human being, he's being found in that human form, He humbled himself by becoming obedient unto death, even death on a cross. I mean, Mojica is a cool story. It really is. You go, wow, what a great heart that wants to live with his people and hang out with his people and serve his people. Isn't that the story of Jesus? Incredible story for Jesus to come down and to live like us and to die for us, to give us opportunity. I mean, he did something about it. He did something about our sin problem. He did something about our heart problem. And he expects us to do the same. So I ask the question, what does God want me to do with my power and my wealth? What does he want me to do with it? I would say to do what Jesus did, serve others with a loving, humble heart, however that may be, whether it's here or if it's other places. Can we help change the world? Yes. I would encourage you today to get on the internet and just look at some ways that you can make a difference in this world. I mean, there's so many needed areas. And I think that we forget that we're given 10 times the cash and 5 die to play this game of life. And other people don't have any cash and no die. They're stuck right where they're at. They can't even move, you know, and so they just have to sit there and wait for something good to happen. And so we can be the change. We can be the difference. So I don't know if you're struggling with anything this morning, but we always have an invitation song. If there's something we can pray about, help you with in any way, we would love to come by your side and encourage you this morning. So if that's the case, Jim's got a song.